Ezekiel 28. The word of the Lord came to me. Son of man, say to the ruler of Tyre, this is what the sovereign Lord says. In the pride of your heart, you say, I am a God. I sit on the throne of a God in the heart of the seas. But you're a man and not a God. Though you think you're as wise as a god, are you wiser than Daniel? Is no secret hidden from you? By your wisdom and understanding, you have gained wealth for yourself and amassed gold and silver in your treasuries. By your great skill in trading, you have increased your wealth, and because of your wealth, your heart has grown proud. Therefore, this is what the sovereign Lord says. Because you think you are wise as a god, I'm going to bring foreigners against you, the most ruthless of nations. They will draw their swords against your beauty and wisdom and pierce your shining splendor. They will bring you down to the pit, and you will die a violent death in the heart of the seas. Will you then say, I am a god in the presence of those who kill you? You will be but a man, not a god, in the hands of those who slay you. You will die the death of the uncircumcised at the hands of foreigners. I have spoken, declares the sovereign Lord. The word of the Lord came to me, Son of man, take up a lament concerning the king of Tyre and say to him, this is what the sovereign Lord says. You are the model of perfection, full of wisdom and perfect in beauty. You are in Eden, the garden of God. Every precious stone adorned you, ruby, topaz, and emerald, chrysolite, onyx, and jasper, sapphire, turquoise, and beryl. Your settings and mountains were made of gold. On the day you were created, they were prepared. You were anointed as a guardian cherub, for so I ordained you. You were on the holy mount of God. You walked among the fiery stones. You were blameless in your ways from the day you were created, till wickedness was found in you. Through your widespread trade, you were filled with violence and you sinned. So I drove you in disgrace from the mount of God, and I expelled you, O guardian cherub, from among the fiery stones. Your heart became proud on account of your beauty, and you corrupted your wisdom because of your splendor. So I threw you to the earth. I made a spectacle of you before kings. By your many sins and dishonest trade, you have desecrated your sanctuaries. So I made a fire come out from you, and it consumed you, and I reduced you to ashes on the ground in the sight of all who were watching. All the nations who knew you are appalled at you. You have come to a horrible end, and you will be no more. The word of the Lord came to me, Son of man, set your face against Sidon. Prophesy against her and say, this is what the sovereign Lord says. I'm against you, O Sidon, and I will gain glory within you. They will know that I am the Lord when I inflict punishment on her and show myself holy within her. I will send a plague upon her and make blood flow in her streets. The slain will fall within her with the sword against her on every side. Then they will know that I am the Lord. No longer will the people of Israel have malicious neighbors who are painful briars and sharp thorns. Then they will know that I am the sovereign Lord. This is what the sovereign Lord says. When I gather the people of Israel from the nations where they have been scattered, I will show myself holy among them in the sight of the nations. Then they will live in their own land, which I gave to my servant Jacob. They will live there in safety and will build houses and plant vineyards. They will live in safety when I inflict punishment on all their neighbors who malign them. Then they will know that I am the Lord their God. Well, Ezekiel 28, and in our readings this week of the Gospel Primer, if you've been reading them with us, we read one day this week, I can't remember which day it was, earlier on in the week, that pride is at the root of all sin. Pride produced the first sin in the garden, and pride always precedes every sinful stumbling in my life. So Proverbs 16:18, pride goes before destruction, a haughty spirit before a fool. And the seriousness of pride is seen throughout the scriptures. So James 4 verse 6, we read, God opposes the proud but gives grace to the humble. Peter in his letter says exactly the same, 1 Peter 5 5. Paul, when instructing us to put on characteristics in Galatians 5, Colossians 3, Ephesians 4, always encourages us to clothe ourselves in humility, presumably because God opposes the proud. Pride is one of the six things the Lord hates, Proverbs 6, 16. Pride is something we all struggle with, whether we know it or not. I remember years ago being at a Word Alive, and I was walking, if you don't know what Word Alive is, a big Christian conference with lots of speakers and seminars, and particularly has a student track, and I was walking behind two students, and I was just kind of overhearing, as you do, their conversation, and one student was saying to the other student about the seminars that were going on, and he said, look, there's a seminar on pride. I really think you should go to it. It's not something I struggle with. And there I was behind, chuckling away, but it highlights wonderfully we're all proud. One student recognizes it in another, but in their comment demonstrates they're proud, and I am demonstrating my pride in finding that story funny. We all struggle with pride in various degrees. And at the heart of all sin is pride. And it's the very attitudes that we see displayed in the King of Tyre. In fact, it's the attitude we see in all the kings of all the nations and in each of our lives. And what we discover in Ezekiel 28, verses 1 to 19, is that God judges the proud. God judges the proud. See, the question one has to ask as we read through these passages of judgment on the nations, which started in Ezekiel chapter 25 and goes through to Ezekiel chapter 32, is why is the king of Tyre singled out? See, flip back to chapter 25. Chapter 25, we read of God's will judge Ammon. And we read chapter 25, verse 3, that he will do so. He will judge Ammon for effectively rejoicing over the desecration of his sanctuary. Then in chapter 25, verse 8, we read of God's judgment on Moab because they delighted in the fall of Judah. In chapter 25, verse 12, we read of God's judgment on Edom for taking revenge on Judah when they are weak. In chapter 25, verse 15, we read of God's judgment on Philistia for taking revenge with malice on Judah. And yet chapter 26 and 28 are given over to Tyre, and chapter 28 is given over to the king of Tyre. Now, were they particularly worse? Well, it doesn't seem so. Chapter 26, verse 2, they'll be judged because of their mercenary actions towards the downfall of Jerusalem. So why? Why do we get this passage on the king of Tyre? Well, we're not told, but I think Tyre and its king is being used as an example to reveal that which is going on ultimately in the hearts of all the kings of the nations, pride. See, if you think about it, all the reasons they're judged stem from their pride. Ammon and Moab are proud that as a nation they're not destroyed, that their sanctuary is not desecrated. Edom and Philistia take revenge on Judah, presumably because Judah had previously humiliated them. And here was an opportunity to restore the nation's pride. And so in many ways, the king of Tyre is just a representative of what is ultimately happening to in all the nations, in all their kings. Possibly he was a king that was demonstrating that much more clearly. Maybe he was more vocal. Maybe he was more obvious. Maybe it just has to do with the circumstances of the day. 26 verse 2, we read Nebuchadnezzar has laid siege against Tyre. And King Tyre did not roll over. It would take Nebuchadnezzar 13 years to defeat him. And presumably for the exiles in Babylon, they would have known this. And so using the king of Tyre as an example would work as people would have known who he was. And maybe, just maybe, the exiles were hoping that if Tyre defeated Babylon, it would be good for them. And once again, they're looking to another nation, a proud one, at that for their salvation and not the Lord. The king of Tyre King of Tyre is just an example, really, I think, of what's happening in all our hearts. And he's just a little bit more obvious. See, King Ethbal II was proud. I mean, he just held out for 13 years against Babylon. He was kind of feeling and fueled by pride at this moment. And his words in chapter 28 reveal how proud he was. See verse 2. In the pride of your heart you say. And then Ezekiel lists three reasons why he's proud. Firstly, the king claims to be divine. You say, I am a god. King Ethbal claims to be equal with Yahweh, the one true God. He sits there and thinks, I am a god. And then secondly, he claims divine authority. I sit on the throne of a god, verse 2. I sit on the throne of a god in the heart of the seas. And Tyre was a nation that was renowned for its shipping. As a country, it was a number of islands. And so effectively, there was King Tyre, King Ethbal, sitting on his throne in the heart of the seas. And he imagines himself to be seated on the throne of God. And sitting on a throne implies authority and control, that he's the one ruling. Now, the king may so imagine himself enthroned among the gods, but Yahweh sees reality for what it is and not what egomaniacs perceive it to be. See verse 2, but you're a man and not a god. Pin, balloon, pop. You're a creature, nothing more. Nothing less. And then thirdly, the king claims divine intelligence. And this claim is cast in the form of a charge by the prophet. You says you think you're as wise as a god. Are you wiser than Daniel? Probably a reference to the Daniel we all know, ruling Babylon. Prophet goes on, there is no secret hidden from you. Now, it's not that the king is not wise. Verse 4, by your wisdom and understanding, you have gained wealth for yourself and amassed gold and silver in your treasuries. By your great skill, you've increased your wealth. There is no doubting the king's wisdom and skill in trade. But this wisdom, limited effectively to trade, has led to his heart growing proud, verse 5, to him thinking that he's wiser than he is. This wisdom that brought him wealth has led him to become proud, to begin to think he's a god. To begin to think he's as wise as a god. And not only to think it, but to articulate it. So he says, I am a god. So here he is, thinking he is a god, claiming divine authority, claiming divine intelligence. Do you see what he's doing? In his pride, he is dismissing God, and he's replacing God with himself. He's declaring autonomy. There's a bloke in Australia called Leonard Hutt. Now Leonard, or more specifically His Royal Highness Prince Leonard, decreed in 1970 that an area he owned, 75 square kilometres, he declared an independent sovereign state. He succeeded from Western Australia and the Commonwealth over draconian wheat quotas, and using arcane provisions of British common law, you've got to love it, set up his own state and ruled over it ever since. Has its own government and laws, its own post office, passports, stamps, coins. His son's the Prime Minister. His daughter, I think, is the Foreign Minister. It goes on. Leonard has declared autonomy from Australia. He set himself up as his own little ruler. And he's determined his own little rules. And he's decreeing what is best. In his pride, he's dismissing Australia and replacing it with himself. I can do better. In effect, that's exactly what the king of Tyre is seeking to do. In his pride, he's claiming he is God. He is sovereign. He can do what he likes. And it's what each of the kings of chapter 25 did as well. In their pride, they declared autonomy and replaced God with themselves, living and ruling with no reference to Yahweh. In their pride, they think they know best. In their pride, they think they are like God. Sounds familiar, doesn't it? Genesis 3. And when we sin, our proud hearts do the very same thing. We're declaring autonomy. We dismiss God and replace God with ourselves. And like the king of Tyre, we're in effect claiming to be God, claiming divine authority over my little kingdom. We're claiming divine intelligence. We know best. And what drives such thinking, like the king of Tyre, is a proud little heart screaming, "I am God." Verse 6, therefore this is what the Sovereign Lord says and thinks about such behaviour. Because you think you are wise as a god, because you think you are a god, I'm going to bring foreigners against you. And in effect, God is going to humble this proud king. He's going to reveal who is truly king, and he's going to do it in three ways. Firstly, these nations will attack the source of the prince's pride, the symbol of his wealth and glory. They will, do you see verse 7? Draw their swords against your beauty and wisdom. And his beauty and his wisdom was seen in the magnificence of Tyre with its beautiful buildings and other treasures, and they'll be destroyed. And then secondly, these invaders will desecrate the prince's radiant splendor. To desecrate it is to profane that which is holy. Here's the king of Tyre. He thought he was a god. So these invaders will desecrate all that the king has set up to make himself look divine. He'll be seen to be no god at all. And then thirdly, these invaders will send the king down to the pit. The king will exchange his falsely secure position in the heart of the seas for the world of the dead. The one who dares to claim the status of deity and demands to live among the gods must join the dead in the pit. Will you then say, verse 9? I'm a god in the presence of those who kill you? No, it will become apparent. He's not a god, he's just a man. And he'll die the worst kind of death, a death at the hands of the uncircumcised, verse 10. He will be judged. I have spoken, declares the Sovereign Lord. See, God will and does judge the proud. He is the true and living God. He is sovereign, and he will oppose all those who set themselves up in his place. Kings, nations, you, me. He's the one who puts these kings in places. He's the one who gives us all we have. He is the one who is truly sovereign. And this is revealed in what comes next. See verses 11 to 19. It's labeled as a lament, presupposing the death of the king. But far from grieving the king's death, its concern is to vindicate Yahweh's judgment upon the man. Upon the king. But in doing so, it vindicates God's judgment in effect on all proud men and women. And it does so first by showing how this is a universal problem by taking us back to the fall. See, verses 12 to 14 seem a little odd. Ezekiel uses the language from Genesis 2 and 3 to describe the king of Tyre. So the king is described as being present in the beginning of the world in Eden, the garden of God. He was even anointed as a guardian cherub, one of the heavenly beings, described as the Lord's throne bearers in Ezekiel 1 and 10. Known in Genesis 3 as the guardians of the sacred garden. The king had access to the center of the divine presence, being on the holy mount of God, walking amongst the stones of fire, a picture of freedom and supervisory role. The language sets up the king as the first of all men, greater than even Adam. Now, Ezekiel is not affirming literally that King Ethbal II of Tyre was there, or that he was an altar Adam, or that he was literally a bejeweled guardian cherub. But rather, he's using the language to highlight the great height from which the king of Tyre would fall. See, the language of verses 12 to 14 indicates the kind of enormous privilege and responsibility that are entrusted to those who wield human power and authority. The king is God's, as it were, officially designated signet. That's what it literally means, verse 12, the model of perfection. He's literally this officially designated signet, his guardian cherub, his gardener. God appointed him. God made him king. And the implication seems to be that there is nothing intrinsically wrong in being a king or in being wise and wealthy. These things were gifts of God, entrusted to this king by God to rule. But just as Adam and Eve were entrusted with all the wealth of the earth's resources to manage and care for with delegated authority, just as God gave authority to Adam and Eve, God stands behind the throne of Tyre. But just like the first human family, the king of Tyre had succumbed to the temptations of wickedness and to pride. And in pride, he claimed to be like God and to declare autonomy. And Ezekiel uses the narrative of the fall to underline that what happened in the garden was not something that just happened to Adam and Eve. It describes a reality that recurs again and again in human history. See, the fall of the king of Tyre could be described and is in terms drawn from the story of the original fall. Because at the heart, what the king of Tyre does is exactly the same thing that Adam and Eve did. It's God's appointed declaring autonomy. It's God's appointed sinning, arising from pride, in pride thinking they could be like God and declaring autonomy. It's what all the kings of chapter 25, including Tyre, did, seen in their attitude towards Judah, and it's what we do every time we sin. And verses 15 to 19 then reveal God's fair judgment for such pride in a series of accusations and judgments. And this time, as he judges Tyre, he does not do so with the kind of specificness of verses 7 to 10, but with a kind of a general feel drawn from Genesis 3. And he does so that we also feel that this judgment is for all who are proud. So verses 15 to 16, because of the king's violence and sin, he'll be driven out of God's presence. Verse 17, because of his pride and corrupted wisdom, wisdom that allowed him to think he could be God, he's thrown to the earth and made a spectacle of. Verse 18, because of his sin, desecration of sanctuaries, he's consumed by fire, eternally separated from God. And it's not hard, is it, to see the echoes of Genesis 3, driven out of God's presence, thrown to the earth. Adam and Eve, not literally, but many ways of thrown at the mercy of the earth. And judgment for sin is clearly seen. Death, eternal separation from God. God judges the proud. And how will he judge the proud? All like Adam and Eve, this king, these nations, you and me. He'll drive us from his presence. He'll make a spectacle of us. And he'll consume us with fire, eternally separating us from him. See, just think about the final day, that final judgment. See, all those who oppose God, who are proud and think themselves God, will stand before the Almighty. And nothing will be left unrevealed. And we'll stand utterly ashamed. We will be shamed and made a spectacle of. And as that shame is seen and all is revealed, we will be driven from God's presence. And how does God, or how does the Bible, phrase eternal separation? Well, Ezekiel 28, 18, consumed by fire. Think of Revelation 20, verse 14, thrown into the lake of the fire. God will oppose the proud, He will judge the proud. He will judge those who declare autonomy, who decree they are a god. And God keeps warning us against such behavior. For examples like the king of Tyre, he'll warn us in Acts 12 when he demonstrates King Herod in exactly the same language of King Tyre here being judged for his proud actions. He'll warn us again in Revelation 17 and 18 when he'll speak of Babylon again using the same language of Tyre to warn us of pride and judgment of such folk. God judges the proud. And each of us falls into this, as Graham was saying this morning, whether we're extrovert or introvert, whether we're hiding or we're revealing, whether in our envy, in our false humility, in our failure to take risks, in evangelism, every time we sin, we're proud. Even if we don't articulate it, like the king, we think it. We think we have divine wisdom. We think we know best, that we have divine authority. We rule our little worlds. And we need to see our pride for what it truly is, and that we're all proud. Pride has plagued us since the garden. We need to see it is truly offensive and that God judges hearts. That to be proud would be to be driven from God's presence, to be made a spectacle of, and to be consumed with fire, eternally separated from Him. And we need to see that our only hope is the mercy of Jesus. That only by Jesus taking our sin, our pride, can we be spared such judgment. Because by taking our sin, He takes our punishment that we rightly deserve. He then clothes us in His humble righteousness, so that we may stand as those who are humble servants before our sovereign God, rightly in relationship with Him and rightly dependent on Him. And as those who stand forgiven, we need to preach the gospel to our hearts. Because in the words of the gospel primer, nothing suffocates my pride and my thoughts that I know best, that I am a God, more than daily reminders regarding the glory of God, the gravity of my sins and the crucifixion of God's own Son in my place. To see, as it were, the cost of my autonomy. The quicker I kill my pride, the less I will sin, the less I will want to declare autonomy and function as God. God opposes the proud, be it kings or nations or little subjects like us. And somehow in our discussions with non-believers, we have to find ways for them to see what their hearts, their sin is actually saying. That what they're actually declaring is, I am God, I know best, I have divine authority, I can rule. And the way we help them is by showing them the mess our so-called rule and kingship brings, personally, socially, eternally. That they would see personally, in seeing how sin messes up relationships and messes up their identity and their security and their confidence. That they would see socially, how their sin has so corrupted and defiled God's world, that this world, the suffering within it, is not how the ruler meant it, but brought about by our ruling. And we need to see that ruling yourself will have disastrous effects eternally. We need to help them to see these things, because pride is dangerous for so many reasons, none less the judgment of God. See, the pride of the nations of their king had disastrous effects. It did then, and it still does today, because God judges the proud. And then secondly, in verses 20 to 26, God judges to reveal His sovereignty and security. See, the question that surrounds these oracles of judgment on the nations is, why are they here? What purpose does revealing the judgment of the nation serve to a bunch of exiles in Babylon? And verses 20 to 26 tell us. Four times in six verses, we're told that through these judgments, people will know the Lord. See verse 22, 23, 24, 26. And in verses 20 to 23, we see that although God is judging Sidon, it also reveals part of the purpose of judging on the nations. That is that through His judgment, God will be made known. And it fits with what we've just been seeing about the king of Tyre and by implication the other kings, that in their pride they think they're God, but in judgment, it will become very clear. that actually the God of Judah is the true God, is truly sovereign. See, in judgment, God reveals that he is God, not us. Now, we're going to think a lot more about that the next time we're in Ezekiel. But for now, we need to know that this judgment on the nations is revealing God, that God is made known. And in many ways, that's true for the final judgment. Think about that last day again. On that day, every knee will bow. All will see who the true God is, who truly is sovereign, who truly is in charge. We will, as it were, be vindicated for placing our trust in him. It'll be clear to all that he is the true God. And so part of his judgment is God revealing himself to the nations, to all he is, that he is the one true God. And then verses 24 to 26 reveal another purpose for God's judgment on these nations. And in many ways, it's the primary purpose, or at least here in Ezekiel, for why God does it. See, in many ways, these verses are slightly out of place. Because here we find not condemnation of the foreign nations, but words of hope and security for Israel. And they're centered right in the middle of all the oracles of judgments against the nation. So there's 97 verses from 25 verse 1 to 28 verse 23. And there is 97 verses from 29 verse 1 to 32 verse 32, the end of the oracles. And the positioning is not accidental. It is done to emphasize this is the purpose of God's judgment on the nations and for including it in Ezekiel. See, these verses of judgment are here to provide a backhanded message of hope to Israel. That God's actions against their enemies will ultimately mean their own future will be secure in spite of the catastrophe happening in Jerusalem. In spite of the fact that Nebuchadnezzar is against Jerusalem, is about to defeat it. We read this, verse 25. When I gather the people of Israel from the nations where they've been scattered, I will show myself holy among them. Then they will live in their own land, which I gave to my servant Jacob. They will live there in safety and will build houses and plant vineyards. They will know, verse 26, that I am the Lord their God. See, these judgments reveal their God is in charge, is sovereign. And because of that, they're utterly secure. On that day, they will know that he is the Lord their God. And again, that's true on the final day of judgment, isn't it? On that day, all that might harm God's people, sin, its presence, all who will oppose will be removed, leaving a world no longer defiled, where the people have been purified and perfected, which is why Revelation 21, God can promise with utter assurance that he'll wipe away every tear, that there'll be no death or mourning or crying or pain, and all that might harm is removed. See, in judgment, God reveals he's sovereign. And in judgment, he reveals that his people are utterly secure and safe. And in judgment, he's working that out even now, protecting and guarding his church, his people, in judgment and in salvation, so that his church grows even amongst hostile nations, so that his people grow even amongst a hostile world. In judgment, God reveals he is sovereign and that his people are secure.